This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 416 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Carlene Z.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with, we're starting part three, first of all. Part three is entitled Privateer, and we'll be beginning this episode with chapter 23 entitled Correspondence from the Front.
There's not just this chapter, but like these four chapters. There's a lot of letters, huh, Sam?
Yeah, I generally don't like letters.
The reason I do like letters is because we get dates and names and places. However, other than that, they can be extremely a lot. Or, you know, like, get me to the storyline. I don't want to have to read 18th, Diana's version of 18th century language, which is like highfalutin and, you know, dances around the top. Like, it's like Ginger, but older language. Dances around the topic and like you have to read, oh, in the postscriptum, it's like, oh, by the way, so-and-so was shot and killed on the first day of January. I'm like, that's all I needed to know. I don't need to know where he got his apples from.
What if you needed to know all of it? You might have needed
to
know.
Who did his fishing for him? No. Okay, so yes, a lot of letters. Okay, let's go. October 3rd, 1776, William to Cuz Dorothea. New Bern, North Carolina. He's writing from there. April 1777. Look, girl, I'm going on an adventure. Don't know when I'll be back. If you want to get a hold of me, write in the care of your brother, Adam. I'll try to keep in touch with him. I put the wheels in motion on your plan. I've done my best. Peace out. That's first letter. Was that nice and short?
That was a good summation.
I have an
email where
I'm pretty decent at that. I'm not great at a ton of things, but I, for someone who is quite verbatious, I think I just made that up. Verbal and loquacious, verbatious. For someone who is quite verbal, hyperverbal, I can kind of summarize things. Not myself.
I was like,
not myself. No. I do not claim that. Okay. October 2nd. So the day before. 1776. Sex. Okay.
Wow. You got something on your brain?
To my knowledge,
Ginger?
There's no sex in these chapters. Ha! No. 1776. William to Lord John, or AKA Daddy. Look, Dad, I'm going to go into the unknown with Captain Richardson, acting as his interpreter. I haven't met the Randall Isaacs dude, but I'll see him next week. I will write when I can. Yo, peace out. That's number two.
Okay.
The third chapter. Excuse me. No. Letter. Late October, 1776. Quebec.
That's not a letter, though.
You're right. It's just a chapter. Part of the chapter.
I prefer this part.
Late October, 1776. Quebec. William meets Dennis Randall Isaacs. Now, Randall Isaacs didn't talk much about himself, though he did tell a little about his origins. We learn, I don't know if the first time you read through, I read through, someone read through, they noticed it right away. Obviously, now we know what's up. But there's enough in there, I think, to read between the lines, because we're supposed to get that who his mama and daddy were. So he did tell us a little bit about his origins. His father was, quote, an officer of dragoons, had died in the Highlands campaign before, quote, his birth. And his mother had remarried a year later, and she had remarried a Jewish man. So he was a year old about under a year when his mom had remarried. We get a little more info about Lord John. As William is traveling with Randall Isaacs, they are in Quebec. As I said, they're approaching the citadel of Quebec. William tells Randall Isaacs, okay, not so much in speech, but in typing. That's a long name to type out 87 times. So I just wrote Randall I. So I'm going to call him Randall I. Okay.
I would have said so William R-I, tells like Rhode Island.
R-I. No, because that would make too much sense. And my brain thinks around and makes up more things difficult.
Got it.
Randall I. But because Randall I sounds like Randall Isaacs, it's just not all the letters or sounds. So William tells Randall I that his father had made that climb. They're looking at over at the Citadel of Quebec 17 years before. As he and Randall I are chatting, he realizes why he's been asked to accompany him. They can get an interpreter, you know, anywhere if they really want one, right? They could have gotten someone local to Quebec. Maybe not as trustworthy, but you know what I mean. He is there to serve as his calling card. His dad, Lord John, knows everyone. Knew everyone. He was very, Randall I was very interested in Lord John. But now that he knew what his role was, William, what exactly, he wonders, was Randall I's role? We cannot answer that. We're still getting used to this. Let's go and see if there are any comments, questions about the chapter, chapter 23. Okay, so with the comments in the Facebook group. Yeah, commenting. Oh, I think it was, so just one comment about, yes, as Summer addressed, the nice to see Claire in the outfit she was in for the
no longer wearing that giant coat.
Yes. Oh, that. Yes. Correct. And just to remind you guys, feel free at any time to throw in questions or comments or anything about the chapter. If you already have read ahead, or if you're listening to us and something doesn't make sense, or you disagree with what we say, doesn't matter. Anything and everything. Our goal is to pause between each chapter and read your comments. So we want to be able to involve you guys as well.
All right, moving right along to chapter 24, entitled Joyeux Noël.
London, December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1776.
You're all getting all your dates today.
What?
I said you're getting all the dates today.
I'm telling you. I'm told you. My English is sometimes great. Lord John and his madam friend. It's Christmas Eve, and he's woken up his prostitute friend from her sleep. How rude. I learned a new word. I did not look it up, so I cannot promise you. Well, it's a piece of clothing, but I can look it up now. It's sack in English. Suck. Bed suck. Let's see what comes up. SACQUE. Bed suck. Oh, that's Etsy. I don't care about when someone made bed. Bed sack back. Okay, maybe we're not going to find that. Okay, we're not going to find it quickly and easily, so let's go forward. I think it was like the thing she put over her, like a gown or something.
Either a robe or maybe like the blankets from the bed.
Exactly. Kiva, baby girlfriends, that's a kitty. Mm-mm. Lord John, brings her sweeties every time he visits. And as an apology also for having woken her. And I wrote, it's not enough. You wake me Christmas Eve in the middle of the night or whatever it was. No thanks, sir. You need to bring me twice the violets, twice the violet candy. But her name is Nessie. And if you didn't know she was Scottish from that, you're sure as heck would know as you either listen to her on the audio or read Diana's writing. It's all, not all, it's a lot of Scots or dialect, I guess. Scots dialect. Why is Lord John here? Minnie's footman had woken him up just before dawn with summons to go to Argus House. So Argus House is where Hal and Minnie's abode. Back to the present, to the room at hand, he sees that Nessie indeed has a companion with her. She just says, oh, that's just Rob.
Yeah, no, she's like the Hercules Mulligan of Hamilton, where she's...
Oh, my.
Where she gets around. She's an intelligence agent who gets her information from men she sleeps with.
Oh, we're
going to
get there. Yeah. Yes. There's a reason those... when I say those types of women, that sounds very disparaging, and I acknowledge that. There's a reason that women in this role, who are already in this role, and maybe do it because of that, have in history been used as... or have functioned as intelligence operators, intelligentsias. I don't know the right term. Spies, I guess. So the guy who's been asleep in her bed until now-ish is named Rob. And she speaks. So she asks Lord John if he wants to do a three-way. And he's like, nah, it's all good. But now we finally find out why Lord John is there. As Summer said, she is also an intelligence agent. But he's in a hurry. He tells her he's bound for France that very morning. But he had just come or is going. He learned that Hal had a shock. They received word that his youngest son had been wounded in America and had been captured. This would be Henry. So this woman, and she's kind of filling in the blanks. She's like, oh, that's Henry. I heard about this and that. She's like, yeah, she knows a lot about that family. Maybe not what's happening in America, but she knows a lot about the names and goings on of Hal and Minnie and their family.
I will say, Ginger, that if we get closer to the end of this section, it says she pulls... Where did it go? Clutching at the dressing gown closer. So I'm sure her bad sack.
Oh, so maybe it's a bed sack as a dressing gown. Yeah, that makes sense. But he's... Oh, I already said that. But this conversation, the reason he's there is about William. So they get it on, the convo, that is. But that's where it pauses. Diana, I think a lot of writers do this, right? Like they have a scene, the scene is start to end. They cut it off in the middle to go elsewhere. And later in a memory or flashback, you get the end of the scene. So that's where it cuts off. They start talking and get down to business, but we don't see any of it or hear any of it. After he's done with Nessie, he goes to see Hal and Minnie and update them, or at least Hal, about what he's found out. So what he'd found out was he'd received a letter inside a letter for himself. So it was, you know, secreted in there. But he didn't want to share anything with him until he'd seen Nessie. The letter had included information about known French connections of Percival Beauchamp. So Percy, right? Percy had been seen often in the company of Beaumarchais, who's a French, I can't say general, but he's in the French government or military. And he'd also been seen with Silas Deane, an American merchant in Paris, who was in Paris on behalf of the American Congress. So we don't need to retain all of this necessarily, but the most important thing is that this is intelligence about Percy. And so that's the main connection there. So that's why Lord John's going to France. He's planning to go there and then return to England. So it's now Christmas Eve. He wants to go to France the next day, return to England by the end of March, and then travel to the colonies the next year by the new year. So in the fall, whatever. It's Christmas now. So December 1776, he'll be in France from now-ish through March 1777, because it's almost the next year, and then on a ship to the colonies by the end of December, by the new year of 1777. And he promises to bring Henry back. So that's what that conversation is with Hal's about Henry predominantly. And then they're discussing Hal's health. Gray thinks that it's his heart, but Hal doesn't. He says, no, it's got to do with not being able to breathe. So they don't have either the diagnosis, quote unquote, because it either doesn't, the diagnosis or the language doesn't exist. The word for asthma doesn't exist yet. Although I don't think that's necessarily the case, but definitely no doctor has told him he has this certain condition yet. But he absolutely knows his symptoms, and that is not being able to breathe. This is when he chooses to tell Hal about Dottie and William. And Hal's like, okay, yeah, and? Go for it. Hal gives him his blessing with absolutely no care. I can't say no care, but like, he's like, you know what? I know that he'll treat her right and he'll protect her. And you know what? If I do end up dying because of this whatever thing that's not my heart, but it is my breathing, if that does kill me, I know that I'll leave this world and she'll be in good hands. So I can get that. I can get that. Did you have any, not concern, but like surprise over how quickly he's like, okay, good. Let him go.
I mean, it was a different time.
Oh, well, heck yeah.
I'm like, it was a different time. I would not have. Actually, they're not related, so it doesn't matter. They're not really related.
Oh, well, yeah, they're not related by blood. That's correct. Okay.
So I guess he has plenty of money based on his parentage or who his stepfather and family was.
Oh, yeah. So exactly. He's not there. He's not there for riches to get her money.
So he's like, cool. Now, does Hal know? I don't remember. About William's bastard status?
Okay. I cannot answer that at this point. We do. I will say, I mean, either way, I cannot answer. I do not know if he knows right now, but I will say this much. The reader will know the answer to that question by the end of Echo.
Okay.
By the end of book 7.
The one we're reading.
Correct. Yes, this one.
But this one?
Yeah, that one. So before leaving for Dover, he'd told Dottie that he'd solidified her plans and she could go ahead. So now Dottie has an okay from a clearance from William and clearance. Well, she may not have gotten the letter from William yet. Oh, it's been a month or two. Who knows? But she definitely will end up soon having clearance from the all clear green light clearance, so many terms for going ahead with her plan. Whatever that may be, we do not know. As if you're a new reader, you do not know at this point yet. Well, to our eyes, it's her and William, right? That's what we're being told. Lord John had kept a piece of info from Hal. In his chat with Nessie, he'd found out that Percy did not come to her place. Meaning, like, how did she find out about stuff, right? Was Percy frequenting her establishment? No. If you're a madam and you're in the biz, you know, you have friends in the biz and you know, you're going to know about all the body houses in town, right? Because it's your job to know. He was known to frequent another body house called Jackson's. And he asked her, Lord John asked her, slightly changing the subject, he mentions a new name. He's like, oh, have you heard about Randall I? Now, this name stayed with him. And she did this name had stayed with him, with Lord John. He was known to associate with Percy. Quote, it might be no more than coincidence that a man known to associate with Percy Beauchamp had taken William on an intelligencing expedition to Quebec, but damned if he thought it was. Unquote. So yeah, that's a little bit too much of a coinky dink. And Nessie, when he asks her this, reacts abruptly to the name. So yes, that shows that she has heard the name. She says, yeah, I've heard of him. It said he's a Jew and he is also associated with Percy. Quote, for it was a girl from Jackson's told me about the Jewish cove. I think I got that word right. Cove. I don't know what else it could be, but cove, and that doesn't make sense, but it's what I wrote. She told me about the Jewish cove and what a shock it was to her.
It is cove.
It is cove, okay. When he took his breeches off, unquote. Meaning a girl who was at Jackson's was going to be with a Jewish man, Percy. But she says she wouldn't, or I guess it was a different person. I guess cove means like, I don't know, group? Community, I don't know, because she did not have sex with Percy. Percy was there with another guy, and the other guy was, we're talking about Randall Isaacs. I'm such a nerd. Percy's associated with Randall Isaacs. How so? How does Nessie know? Because a girl from Jackson's said that she was with him and she would not have been with him, but Percy was there and wanted to watch. So she did. So we now have Nessie telling John that she knows, I guess, secondhand, but from the girl who had the experience, who had been with Randall I while Percy watched. We don't know the connection between Percy and Randall I, but there is something. So that's a little shady, right?
Can you imagine, though, that time period as a person of today's age? We are shocked for completely different reasons with men's penises, because now everything we expect them to be cut, and they were clearly expecting them to not be cut. So when they didn't have the little extra turtleneck or helmet on the front, they were all confused. And they were like, that doesn't look normal. I was like,
where are you going? Oh, Lord.
But that's the same thing that would happen now if somebody showed up with foreskin that they weren't expecting it. I think.
So we got another letter. Oh, okay. Cat wants down. Oh, there you go. December 24th, same night. 1776. This time it's William to Papa. He's writing from Quebec City. He's writing from a convent.
I'm pretty sure it's Papa.
And, sorry?
Papa. Oh, Papa.
Yeah, sorry. You're right. Papa. He's writing from a convent. He says, Randall and I arrived in late October, intending in Quebec City, intending to call upon Sir Guy. Now, I think Sir Guy is a Brit, but I don't know if it's an anglicized French person, or at least the name, because the name is French. So I always want to say Sir Guy, but I'll probably flip back and forth, but I'll try and say Sir Guy. Intending to call upon Sir Guy, but Sir Guy had already marched away to deal with other military issues.
Now it just sounds like you're mispronouncing Sergey.
Sergey, you're funny. William was like, oh, so we were going to meet him here, but he's not here now. Well, let's go to him. I'm happy. You know, he was happy to go join him in whatever issue, military thing he was going to do. But Randall I did not want to. Supposedly, he says, due to the distance and time of year, which actually made sense. Distance, they don't tell us how far away he was. But soon thereafter, like the next day, but because like the snow's now coming in. So William's like, okay, I'm actually kind of glad we didn't go. But soon thereafter, they heard the news that the skirmish had already taken place. So even if they had gone and the weather was not snowy, it was already past the time that they would have been able to do anything or help out in any way.
I think the weather that they're experiencing is indicative of how long this letter is.
Oh my. Like, yes. And I promise you
must be stuck in the snow.
My rendition of it is not that long.
Nothing else to be done.
So he's relaying, William is relaying to Lord John what happened with Sir Guy and Colonel Arnold. And Colonel Arnold is Benedict Arnold.
Ooh.
This is a skirmish between the Brits and the Americans in Quebec, or in at least part of Canada. What is now Canada. Along this, he tells about his environment where he's staying. So he's relaying what happened, what he knows what happened between Sir Guy and Colonel Arnold, the skirmish, right? This battle. But in between, he doesn't just sit and tell about the battle. And he writes this in multiple sittings because it's Somerset. It's a long letter. But he's also telling him, oh, by the way, I'm at this convent and this nice like Mother Superior, like blah, blah, blah. You know, he talks. So he's interjecting in his own letter about what he's experiencing at that moment and not just relaying a past story that he was told. So along this, he tells about his environment where he's staying at the convent. It's Mother Superior who says she knows him because everyone and their dog knows Lord John. I mean, we thought Jamie knew people.
Ranjay?
I guess it's safe to say that if Jamie doesn't know the person, Lord John will.
It's John Gray. Grande.
Oh, seriously. Yes. Mother Superior tells William of Lord John when he was taking part in the... He was part of the taking of the Citadel in 1759. So she knows him from that, from then. I think it was 20, not quite, almost 20 years earlier. Once the battle was done, this was between Sir Guy and Arnold and their troops. Sir Guy won, by the way. He returned his prisoners, so the American prisoners, to Ticonderoga under a flag of truce. So that was very nice of him. He didn't keep prisoners of war. That was very nice. And then he withdrew to his winter quarters in St. John. And he tells Lord John, Sir Guy will not return to Quebec until spring. Quote. Summer, you're going to laugh at this. Quote.
Don't tell me what I'm going
to
do.
So now I come to the point of my letter.
Wow. So you wrote this
my
letter.
My dudes. Shut your face.
And let me give you a bunch of meaningless backstory. And now that I've gotten all of that out of my system.
Now that I've spilled ink on 27 pages of paper that cannot be saved, let me get to my point. Dude, William, please. Not cool. That's what I wrote. Like, that's not cool. Okay. What he says is he'd woken up the day before, which was, I'm guessing it was the 23rd, to discover that Randall I had left him during the night. He did leave a note, but that was all he left. He said only that he had urgent business. He had enjoyed William's company and he was to remain. William was to remain there until he returned or until he received orders. Love you. Happy Christmas.
Right. Good Lord.
And then P.S. I went to the chapel. In the end, I finally did go to the chapel, my dude. That's it. That's the letter.
I'd have been like,
so the whole point of that letter. Sorry?
No one gets to tell me I have to stay in Quebec and wait who knows how long for a dude to come back. No thanks.
So the point of that letter, although it's interesting. I mean, I understand why he's telling his dad. And it's news. Fine. And he's in the military. So it makes sense he's sharing like a British victory. Like, great. That it's not too tangential to their relationship or to their circumstance. So that makes sense that he talks about it. But if the entire reason you're writing the letter is to tell him, like, hey, that dude that took me up on this little trip to Quebec, like, yeah, he ditched me. Like, he left, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. So toodaloo, Merry Christmas, right? So anyway.
We'll now be moving on to chapter 25, entitled The Bosom of the Deep. And what I like about this and the way this chapter is written is that he is writing the letter as the chapter is happening. So it's a little bit of letter and then what's going on, and then a little bit more letter and then what's going on around him. So it's much more plot driven than most of the other letters are.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. Yes, it was a sweet chapter, but it's more letters, or at least one more letter.
I do think that Captain Roberts is the Dread Pirate Roberts in my head.
I thought about that. Mm-hmm. I made that connection. Not connection, but I had that thought too. May 15, 1777. Just because it's in this cluster of chapters, and I've already detailed it out for my own benefit in my brain, although I described it too, John is most likely on his way to the colonies by now, because he was going to be back by April, back by the end of March from his trip to France. He's going to be back in England by the end of March, and he wanted to be on a ship to the colonies by the new year. May is nowhere near the new year. However, it's decent sailing weather, and why not, right? He wanted to go as soon as he could, sometime before 78. So this is another letter from Jamie and Claire to the Mackenzies. And these letters, I mean, I appreciate almost all letters just because, again, as I said, they give you a date and a time and generally a place. Helps anchor the story, I think. But these are these I can never get enough of. These, I eat them up. I love them. And it's also interesting that, I don't know, it must not have been interesting enough because it left my brain. So Jamie reminds us that, or them, sorry, not us. He reminds the Mackenzies that he hates boats.
I don't think they needed to be reminded.
We know this. We know this.
His seasickness is definitely.
Yes. So they're aboard. I definitely did not make this connection. Not connection. I don't remember the full name of the boat until I wrote it down. So they're aboard a boat called the Tranquility. Tranquility, right? It's two words.
Tranquil
Teal. The captain's name is
Tranquil Teal.
Trusty. He says, yeah, Tranquil Teal is what the boat
Teal.
Is. Oh, it's Tranquil Teal? Yes. Thank you. That's much better than the little play on words my brain was trying to make. So the captain's name is, he says, is Trustworthy Roberts. And the boat's name is Tranquil Teal. But it's called the Teal.
Right. But before he tells us his name is Trustworthy Roberts, he describes him, and he's a smuggler of mixed race, evil countenance, and low humor, who tells me straight face that his name is Trustworthy Roberts.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was a great name. So they're finally, this is what I think as the reader, your initial thought is supposed to be. They're finally on their way to Scotland. That's what he says in the letter, right? He asks Claire if he should tell them about Fergus. And she's like, well, yes. So in his letter to the Mackenzies about what happened to Fergus, we learn what happened to Fergus. He tells them about Percival Beauchamp and his interest in Fergus, and that Fergus did not speak with him. And as Jamie was meeting with someone related to their upcoming journey, the one they're on now, he found out that there had been an assault upon a printer named Mr. Fraser, which was Fergus, in New Bern the day before. It's the story of the attempted kidnapping of Fergus. So what happened was someone had slipped a sack over his head, and a second person had attempted to grab his hands, I'm guessing to tie them together. But he had avoided this by attacking that second person with his hook. Now Clarence, whom we all love, whom he'd been riding, bit the other dude. And locals poured out of a pub to see what was going on.
I thought you said, the no, I thought you said writing and not writing. And I was like,
oh, writing?
We love Clarence. I thought Clarence was a donkey. Why is he writing Clarence a letter?
Look, donkeys deserve love letters too.
Okay.
So locals are like, what the heck's going on? We have no TV or internet. This is our entertainment. Let's go. So of course they poured out into the street to see what was happening. Fergus had been so successful in avoiding, quote, the appearance of taking sides in the conflict that both sides are equally likely to have taken offense, unquote. Now, that's a jump. Like, I don't really fill that in. And what the heck does that have to do with his attempted kidnapping? So I did miss a connection there. So basically, Jamie writes in his letter to them, he says, okay, this is what happened. Fergus did not meet with this dude. And then there was this attempted
kidnapping.
And now thinking about, like, why is this happening? Why would he try? Who would try and kidnap him? Right. Well, the two major camps would be the Sons of Liberty, because they would have taken offense to his not being to him, you know, maybe writing in their eyes too much about the loyalist side. And then the loyalists, right? Who in their eyes, he would have been writing too much in support of liberty. So that's how he's been so successful. When both sides hate you and are highly suspect in an attempted kidnapping of you, he's been writing that line. What's the phrase, Sam? Walking that line, like, very, very carefully. He's very successfully pissed off both camps, basically. So it could literally have been anyone or any side, either side, to have, you know, been behind his attempted kidnapping. But Jamie thinks, because of the timing of the attempted kidnapping and the presence of Beauchamp, it could have been him too. So there's a third possibility. One of the two major camps, pro-war, anti-war, not pro-war, but pro-revolution, anti-revolution, right? Pro-liberty, anti-liberty. And then there's this thing that has nothing to do with the war at all. But you have this, you know, the timing is a little bit incredible. I give you that. It could have been a way to, look, if Fergus ain't going to chat with me, I'm going to kidnap him to bring him to me so I can talk with him, right? So Jamie thinks the timing is very strange. But since Jamie's out of office, meaning he's not there in town, he can't be of help. He can't go, you know, help Fergus dig or see what's going on. But he did send a letter to Fergus telling him, like, I can't do much, but there's gold in them thar hills, meaning
and then
Wilmington.
Goldsmith.
Yes, yes. And he's like, look, go here if you need to, when you need it, and you can get what you need and when. And he's left gold for them to draw on as they may need to. So there's talk between them that Fergus and Fam may need to move their print shop elsewhere, especially. And this is like a side note kind of thing, or not a side note. It's like a one little tiny sentence or comment that Diana puts in there that I didn't really, I don't think I wrote it in here, but I remember it. And that was not just the danger that he's in might cause them to have to move the print shop, but also there's little benefit of them staying there, especially with the danger, because the Frasers are, like, no longer on the ridge, right? There's no need for them to stay in North Carolina, is my point at this point.
They don't have
maybe
backup.
In the future, who knows? There's no need to be local. There's no, I mean, believe me, Wilmington or New Bern is not local to the ridge, but it's closer than New York, right? It's a usual, like, they go there several times a year. So it's a usual jaunt for them.
It's closer than Scotland.
They can get there if they need to. Oh Lord, that's true. So we find out the Frasers, Jamie and Claire, are headed for Connecticut. So they are still heading to Scotland, but they need to get to, or the ship they're on right now is going to Connecticut. So this is their first leg of their journey. Claire finishes her letter because Jamie has written so long that he's, like, turned his hand into a knot, and she massages it and everything. So she finishes it. She tells the Mackenzies all about all the boxes that are in the ship's hold, stenciled with the name Arnold. She asked around and found out that it was for Benedict Arnold. The boxes were bound for his sister Hannah in Connecticut. And in the letter, before she closes, Claire urges Brianna to look into Frank's boxes of papers and books from his home office to find an old manila envelope that has a folder with a coat of arms on it. She thinks it might also contain the Beecham family genealogy that Uncle Lamb had written up for her. And she wants her to look and see if there was someone included in that genealogy named Percival, in or around the year 1777.
What a failed task. Because if she never came back, what's the point?
I mean, oh, that's true, because she can never find out the answer.
She's never going to have the answer.
That's a good point. Okay, that's a good point.
I'm just wondering.
Like, why do it?
Like, they had no intention
because if she does
of
it,
going back.
Then, like, great mom is not going to do you any good.
Right. Well, I'll know. I mean, they don't intend to go back.
Yeah, that was never the goal. That was never a conversation.
All right. And that was chapter 25. We will be winding up our read along this week with chapter 26, entitled Stag at Bay. Though it should have been Stag in Rut.
Okay, now we're back to our happy place, Scotland, 1980. We're with the Mackenzies. I don't know why this tickles me. Maybe because it's like we were actually alive during the 80s summer, and like, I know they're fake people. they're complete fiction, but it's like we were alive. It's like the only time in our lifetime that we can align with their timeline. It's Bree's first day at the new job, and Roger bids her good day. Have a great day, hon. Have a great first day. Mandy had inadvertently been left alone in the kitchen with an empty champagne bottle, and she threw it out of the kitchen window, or through a kitchen window. So he's like, oh, Lord. He gets her settled with Annie Mac and begins to get to his work, which currently is he's transcribing more of the songs he'd committed to memory from when he was in the 18th century. He planned to take some of the rarer songs to the choir master of St. Stephen's to help create goodwill. Like, you know, he's new. He wants to offer something that he may not have yet, that this the choir master may not have. And like, this is, you know, this is our history and everything. This is just offer him something that he may not otherwise have, and then begin conversations, etc. With regard to his voice, we find out that he'd already seen two specialists, one in Boston and one in London. And they tell him that surgery might help, but surgery was also extremely risky. And so that's a thing, right? That he's always got that on his mind, his voice. And also with the whole vocation thing, he's struggling again with that. He's like, he's thinking like, how do I pursue that in the here and now? No, my vocation is still there. He thinks he believes, but it was a lot different. Like, I don't know. I think it was easier for him, although life wasn't necessarily easier. Maybe in some ways it was easier for him to hear and honor and make a plan to honor the call, the vocation in the 18th century. But now with things so much different, their circumstances are so much different. Like, is that something that I still have, or can I still pursue it, or how do I do that, or whatever? So yeah, it's a different situation, but he is like, he's, it's funny, people say, you know, they discern to see if they have a call or vocation, right? So what he's doing, and he did discern, and he decided he did have a vocation back in the 18th century. But what he's doing now is he's doing a whole other thing. It was like meta discernment, right? Now he's discerning, do I still have a vocation? Like, it's meta, but whatever. Along with the letters left by Jamie and Claire were a few books. They were very small. Quote, the largest was what was called a crown octavo volume, about 5 by 7 inches, unquote. The smaller one was titled The Pocket Principles of Health by CEBF Fraser, MD, produced by A. Bell Printer, Edinburgh. And he's like, oh, they'd made it to Scotland. And then he's like, well, hold on. They may not have. Like, this is not as, because he's a historian. He knows that things are not always black and white. All it means is that the manuscript made it to Scotland. So he's like, I don't want to get my hopes up too much, but it's very, very, very possible they made it to Scotland. And this is a little bit potential evidence that it's evidence that the potential is there. I don't know how I missed this, or maybe I didn't miss it. I just forgot it. But he opens the book and there is an engraving of the author.
This is, quote, hysterical.
A medical man in a neat tie wig and black coat with a high black stock. From above which his mother-in-law's face looked serenely out at him. Unquote.
I want to know if they tried to make her look
this.
Masculine,
I hope,
or
they
if
do
she
this.
Just like looks like a crossdresser or a lady.
I
want to
see Katrina in a wig and Yeah, yeah. She's already been dressed like a man before. So I mean, and she looked great.
She had short hair, so we know what she looks like with short hair.
Oh, that too. Yeah. The date was 1778, so it wasn't too long. It wasn't too far, or it wasn't too long after when they had been there last. He checked the other book, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, if this is like a pair of them, and I wonder if it's." He's like, "Yep, there was a picture of Jamie." He was sitting in a chair, holding a book and reading to a child with dark curly hair, but from the back, because, you know, they didn't know what she looked like yet. Mandy, of course. And the book was called Grandfather Tales. So this part brought me a tear prick, because not because of the book, but because of what Diana wrote about what Roger was thinking. Quote, such faith they had had to create hoard. To send these things, these fragile documents down through the years with only the hope that they would survive and reach those for whom they were intended. Faith that Mandy would be here. Oh my God, I'm going to get a trip. Phew. That she would be here to read them one day. So it's not just that the documents would last and that they'd find the right people, but hope that their granddaughter would survive, right? Both the trip and the surgery. So that's a whew. That was a tear prick. He looks up just in time to see through the window that Jem, in a coat and carrying a bag of food, is out, just leaving the premises, walking across the field. And he checks his watch, and it's like, it's early. School's not out yet, but he's home early, but where was he headed? What's going on? So some more tidbits of their time in Boston. So this is how, understandably, because it makes sense, we don't get an account of their return, right? We don't get, like, this book does not start with, we came through the stones and we found a car and we got to about, like, we don't get an account of basically the 2 years, maybe three, two or three years that have gone on since they arrived in the 80s or 79 or 80.
I mean, we got a little bit because they had to travel.
No, I'm saying
there.
We don't get it's not a linear account. Right. We get flashbacks or little bits of information that's dumped into chapters like this. So this is, and I say that as a preface to this. So we get some more tidbits of their time in Boston. So Roger had tutored Jem at home in Boston while Bree was with Mandy as she recovered from heart surgery. Quote, it was mostly Jem that had made them go to Scotland rather than stay in Boston. Unquote. It was not only Scotland was their heritage, but also Jem would likely be less conspicuous in Scotland than in America. And yes, fair. The week before, Jem had caught and skinned a rat at school, as you do. Now, it didn't go over very well, but the principal, Mr. Mingus, congratulates him and says, you know what? I get it. That's really awesome. You have these skills. Let's not do it again. It kind of freaks the girls out. Let's just, you know, keep it at home. So he remembers this happening last week, but that he's like, that was, it happened, but he didn't get in trouble. It wasn't a big deal. Like that's the only thing that he knows of that's happened at school. And we learn, or he says, or Diana writes that Jem was headed for the hills, and he realized, oh, like the only thing it could be like with a goal would be the Dunbonnet's Cave. And then more tidbits about their time or arrival in Boston. After they'd arrived through the stones, Jem had seen his first car and had recognized it. And that was when he said for the first time in his 20th century life, vroom. I loved it. A motorist picked them up and took them to a nearby village where they placed a collect call to Joe Abernathy. And from there, Bob is your uncle. Back to the Highlands. He's looking for Jem, but this was interesting, but not, I don't need to write like a paragraph about it. He's following Jem up these hills and he's looking for him, but some buck who's in rut is not after him, but it's a little shaky there. He's like, he doesn't want to get killed, basically. So he finally is like, look, I can't go any further. He yells Jem's name and he finds him. And he knows, again, he knows the cave is up here, but he doesn't know exactly where. And so he has Jem show him where the cave is. So as they kind of start to chatting, and he's asking him, okay, so my dude, what happened? What happened at school? So Jem says he had gotten the strap. And Roger's like, oh, yeah, I got it too when I was young. You know, it happens. It's not great, but, you know, we'll do better, you know? And Jem's like, well, so, and then he asks, like, well, what happened? What did you do to get the strap? And he said, well, a kid at school had said that Catholics would burn in hell. And he'd replied in Gaelic, I fine, I'll see you there then. Mm-hmm. And his teacher had grabbed him by the, Miss Glendennen, had grabbed him by the ear and shook him, and shaken him, and said, we do not speak like that. We speak English.
Ew.
So he replied to her in Gaelic, some combination of amazing Gaelic curses from his granda, which of course she didn't understand, but the principal did, and he was there. So he had taken the strap to him. Not that he was speaking in Gaelic, although that's why the teacher was mad, because he spoke in Gaelic. The principal was mad because of what he said. So that was actually, I don't condone of any corporal punishment, but the reason, he actually had a reason. I'm not saying it was a good one, but hers was not a good reason. His was at least, you know, whatever. So, excuse me. Roger's like, well, how can you go off and just like take off and not tell anyone? He's like, oh, no. I left a note on my bed telling you that you and ma'am that I was going to live rough for a day or two. Just imagine this, what, 8 or 9 or 10-year-old kid.
As you do.
Right.
Hey, at least there was a note. He wasn't really running away. Oh,
absolutely. I mean, he pulled a Randall eye, but I mean, leaves a note and disappears. But at least he says, I'll be back, right? Randall I did not say that.
He kind of did. He said, wait here until I come back.
Jem didn't say wait until I get back.
Randall I.
I'm saying Jem pulled a Randall I, but not really, because he at least said he'd be back in a day or two. Randall I said nothing of the sort. He gave him no end.
There was
time.
No timeline, but he did say, stay here till I'm back. So he didn't intend to come back from the note, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't. Okay, so maybe I didn't get across. I don't think he intended that at all.
To come back?
I think
ever?
He was trying to ditch him. Ditch him. Well, he's trying to get out of, for whatever reason, we don't know yet, but I didn't take it as he really truly meant to come back, whereas Jem absolutely did.
I imagine he wants to hang out more with Percy.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe go back to Jackson.
Beauchamp? What are we saying? Because, you know, I'm just saying, they have much bigger adventures than
he has
with
William. They have better times than him and William, absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, my. So he asks Roger, why is it bad to speak Gaelic? And Roger's like, it is not. And he promises to get everything sorted at school. We do have a comment. So let's go ahead. I'll read that first then. Okay, so Rebecca, thank you so much for commenting. She says, poor Jem, he misses his granda so much. Breaks my heart. Also, the fact that this was the feeling about Gaelic even in the 80s is crazy. You know, that's a very good point. I do believe it absolutely was the case. To what extent, I do not know. How much of that is a dramatic license by Don Deanis? I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying I don't know, right? I haven't read the history of Gaelic or the history of the Highlands to find out exactly what the thoughts were or what the opinion was of Gaelic in the 1980s or late 70s. But absolutely, all signs point to this, that, you know, it was definitely discouraged at the very least.
Join us next time when we will be continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapters 27 through 31, and that is 27, Tunnel Tigers, 28, Hilltops, 29, Conversations with a Headmaster, 30, Ships That Pass in the Night, and 31, A Guided Tour Through the Chambers of the Heart, which is the end of Part 3, Privateer.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Carlene Z. Chat about anything and everything Outlander. Please make sure you're joined our Facebook group, and you can find that at outlanderpod.com/group. And to see our merch, which doesn't change probably as often as it should or update, but we have some, there's some cute things. There's some cute things there. And you can find that at outlanderpod.com/shop. And if you haven't subscribed to our newsletter, the Outlander Pod Gazette, please do. You can do so at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.